Good thing that Scott is here because I'm at a hotel where they're having an evacuation. So Scott is going to give me a hand here. Scott, if you'll kick us off while I, you know, wait for this background noise to end, and I will start inviting myself. I'll mute myself.
That sounds good. Thank you, Jennifer. Good luck with the hotel evacuation. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for Professor Jason Hill and Ask Me Anything. We are very pleased to have him here. Also, David Kelly, the founder of TAS, is in the audience, seeing all the regulars. Dale, glad to see everyone. We're going to start things off with some basic questions, and then we're going to invite anyone that you know, wants to ask Professor Hill a question to come up on the stage. So we look forward to your participation.
Yes, and Jason, if you could, since you open the room first, you're the only moderator. So if you could click on all, then we can do the interface with the audience.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it. So, yeah, let's get started. You know, I think I'm going to be we're going to be having you on our show on Monday. So, I just as some basic background, I know that you know, you're originally from Jamaica and you came here at age 20. You may have shared the story with others, but I'm just curious of just some of the circumstances that you know, that brought you here, and just what some of your you know, your, what was going on during that time.
Sure. So I came here to the States at in my 21st year. I had turned 20, and I mean, I decided I wanted to be an American a long time ago. From I was a child, as far back as I can remember myself. And did high school there, and did also at what's called, I went to a British school, and Jamaica is based on the British model. So we did A levels, which is kind of like advanced high school. And then I worked as an investigative journalist for 2 years, during which time I was reading a lot of philosophy from when I was about 14, Kant and Nietzsche and Bertrand Russell, but they didn't really penetrate my soul until I found the works of Ayn Rand. I'd written some bad poetry, and a friend of mine said, you know, use the word ego and I. So she gave me Ayn Rand's books, and I started with, believe it or not, The Romantic Manifesto and Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology first, because I didn't like The Fountainhead. I disliked it enormously when I first started it. I, of course, fell in love with it, but I started with the nonfiction. And that gripped me intellectually, and I turned to The Fountainhead. And then en route to America, I discovered, I started reading and finished Atlas Shrugged. But it was really Ayn Rand who, I decided I was going to get a PhD. I wasn't sure whether it was going to be one in literature or philosophy. But after I read the Atlas Shrugged, I decided it felt like a vocational calling. Like, I really have to be this philosopher, and I want to be a writer. I'd always planned to write books. As a child growing up, I had always writing, was always taking notes on future books that I would write. But I thought I would be a novelist and get a PhD in literature or something like that, and write general nonfiction books. But Rand was really the one who changed my mind, her works, I should say, in finding a vocational calling in becoming a philosopher, and then, of course, going on to write several books. But her works were very instrumental in penetrating my soul, because they gave me a method of cognition. They gave me a sort of integrated, comprehensive way of looking at things in terms of principles, which I had not got from Bertrand Russell or Nietzsche or even Kant, really, and some other philosophers that I read.
I'm curious just about, you maybe more than most people had an experience of, you know, coming over here and, you know, like Rand, I think seeing that maybe things were moving in the wrong direction a little bit. I mean, did you identify with that with her?
Well, when I first came to America, which was in 1985, I must say that I was so enamored of the country and of the culture that I just soaked up everything. I lived in Atlanta for 8 years, did my undergraduate at Georgia State while working four jobs before I got a scholarship to do my PhD. But I must say that in college, I did see the antecedents of what today we would call cancel culture, wokeism. I mean, I was in college in 1988, where Jesse Jackson formed alliances with a whole bunch of black student organizations, chanting, you know, ho, 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 Western Civ has got to go. And I remember saying, oh, dear Lord, please give me at least 20 years after I become a professor so I can really have a go at it. And I've been a professor for 25 years now. It's all come crashing down. It's all over. The education, the universe is dead. But I did see signs. I did, you know, this was back in the era of DWEMs, dead white European males, which was being bandied about. So I saw the early signs, and I, without being anything of a prognosticator, I was able to sort of project how the proselytization of the classroom that I witnessed in the 80s, also the burgeoning and not so burgeoning proselytization of the classroom and politicization of the classroom. I knew, I could see that in about 20 years' time, the chickens would come home to roost. But I didn't share her virulent attack on the culture as being completely bankrupt, because I saw so many vectors and avenues for rejoinders and for, counterfactuals and just the dissent. And it seemed like as if people were still reading books, important books were being written. You could turn on Dick Cavett, and you could turn on Charlie Rose, and even Phil Donahue was still hosting serious thinkers on their programs. So I still had a lot of hope that the tide would turn and that the country that I had adopted as my own would not fall into the kind of disrepair and complete bankruptcy and nihilism that I think, in my view, we are now ensconced in.
Sure. And I do want to encourage other people to raise your hands. They don't all have to come from us, but Jennifer was kind enough to provide me with a list of questions. Demetrius asks, do you have thoughts on metamodernism? I'm not sure what that.
Well, I don't like when people ask questions without defining their terms, and say by metamodernism, I mean, I have no idea what the term metamodernism mean. I know what postmodernism mean, and I think Stephen Hicks and other people have done a tremendous job at defining what postmodernism is, but I wouldn't dare to advance an answer to a question, the definition of which, of a term of which I have no understanding of what it means. I've never even heard the term. I mean, I've heard the term metamodernism bandied about by people, but I've never heard a proper definition given to it. And I don't want to conjure up what I think it could mean or might mean.
That's fair. Dr. Kelly, thank you for joining the stage. Do you have a question for Professor? You can unmute yourself if you do.
Okay, thank you, Scott. And Jason, hi. It's nice to hear your voice. I wondered if we just go back to your narrative a bit. How did you, once you had your PhD, and can you tell us a little bit about your academic career since then, and getting to the position you're in now?
Right. So I actually did my PhD in 4.5 years because I took a lot. I started college when I was 22 because I came to America at 20. And I took 2 years off after I got my undergraduate degree to read as widely as I could in everything I could put my fingers on, from induction physics to economics, to anthropology, death psychology, all of the collected works of Jung and Freud, military history. And I really spent those 2 years paying off student loans and reading voraciously. So it took me 4 years to do my PhD, and during that time, I was also teaching. Once I got my own class, the first thing I did was make up a syllabus, and I taught Ayn Rand's. It was the first time I was teaching her epistemology, a very audacious move to put it in conversation with parts of the Organon, especially the posterior analytics by Aristotle. Uh-huh. And so I thought that was always Rand's revolutionary and completely original contribution. And I say this now, you know, after having had a PhD for almost 30 years, that her contributions in the field of epistemology are enormously unique and original, because I've read the Organon, I've taught it. So then I started teaching The Virtue of Selfishness and some of her essays in aesthetics. And I got a job at Southern Illinois University, which I in Edwardsville, which I didn't like. So I wrote my first book, which was called Becoming a Cosmopolitan, What It Means to Be a Human Being in a New Millennium, dealing with what it means to be a world citizen and what's entailed by eviscerating from one's psyche strong, what Rand would call remnants of biological collectivism, tribal identities, that is racial, ethnic, national identities that form a constitutive part of yourself. And that got me the job at DePaul. And I subsequently wrote another book, Beyond Blood Identities, which got me tenure. And then I wrote a third book, Civil Disobedience and the Politics of Identity, When We Should Not Get Along, that made me become, along with articles, I was writing scholarly articles along the way too. And that third book got me full professorship quite early on in my 40s. I was, I think, the youngest person in my department to become a full professor. And continued teaching Rand, and then subsequently wrote two more books after that, which I think most people who read my bio will know. I ventured into commercial publishing and have been writing commercial books and a few articles in the field of philosophy of literature, the connection between bipolarity, madness, poetry, and creativity, more specifically Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton's works. So it's been a sweet ride, although it's been a bumpy ride. I had a nasty tenure battle, and I now have a lawsuit against my department because I wrote an article in favor of, I'm radically pro-Israel, and wrote an article in favor of Prime Minister Netanyahu annexing Judea and Samaria, which led to the students taking over the several buildings and leading calls for my resignation. And I was censured by the faculty formally as a genocidal racist and a war criminal and an Arab hater. I was, there was a boycott that was set against my class, so I now have a lawsuit against my university. But so it's been terribly difficult in one, it's been terribly easy professionally to write the books and the articles and to gain ascendancy in the profession. I'm a senior as they come. It's been quite lonely as an outlier, both as someone who identifies as an independent conservative and someone who is a great advocate of Rand's philosophy and teaches her philosophy quite regularly in most of my classes. I find a way of sneaking her in. Just being an outlier for capitalism, for individualism, for the free market enterprise has made me an outlier in not just the university, but I think in the academy as a whole. I'm not a leftist. I'm not a collectivist. I'm the exact opposite of those ghastly phenomena, and so I paid a price, sort of ostracism in some sense, but I don't really care. I mean, I have a very thick spine and spine of steel, and I do what I think is right, and I continue to write my books, and I write for a number of magazines. I'm a columnist for about 5 magazines, and I write at least 3 articles a week or 2 articles a week. So in some sense, the academy has been good to me. In some sense, it's been quite inhospitable to ideas that lie outside the orthodoxy of received wisdom, as defined by, you know, the sentinels and the vanguards of academia. But I'm very inspired by Rand's essay, How to Lead a Rational Life in an Irrational Society, or something like that. And so I just continue to speak the truth as I find it, as I discover it, and not to compromise. But that's a little bit of my background in terms of becoming an academic and staying sane as an academic.
Yeah. Well, I just want to say, and then I'll turn it back to Scott, that, you know, you are, I think, in any way should be a beacon to the many students I've talked with over the years who dropped out of grad school or got so indoctrinated that so browbeaten over their interest in Rand that they either dropped out or just moved away from objectivism. So, you know, your courage and persistence on that score, and as well as productivity, I'd love to, you know, have you, you know, be more or send some of these students that I've dealt with over the years that hear your story, because it's great. So thank you.
Thank you.
Great. And we do encourage everyone to raise your hands if you have any questions for Professor Hill. I have another one here. They say, other than objectivism, where is the strongest kind of pushback to postmodernism coming from today?
Well, that's a rather interesting question. I mean, I think that outside of objectivism, you've got people like Helen Pluckrose and James Lindsay who identify with being on the left, but they're independent thinkers who see the kind of malarchy and the sort of unsubstantiated claims that are made on behalf of postmodernism. I think you're going to find it, but those individuals, and Jonathan Haidt is also one who's not an advocate of postmodernism and has in his own way sort of shown that the antecedents of today's cancel culture and today's woke, what we'd call the woke culture, in his Coddling of the American Mind, I mean, he sort of lays the groundwork for how much of that has arisen in our society. And but I think in my experience as 25 years of being a college educator, is that the biggest pushback comes from this people in the sciences who will have no truck with the idea that there isn't an objective reality, that A is not A, that there are meaning tests that we use to appraise the truth or falsity of claims, that there are various criteria, logical and empirical criteria for testing hypotheses before they become theories. And so I find it coming from the hard sciences, not from law, surprisingly, which is as woke as they come. I mean, I've seen the legals or law schools are bastions of disasters. I mean, I don't know what sort of lawyers we're going to, and what sort of perversions of justice we're going to have. But I find outside of objectivism, it's coming from two sources, independent liberals like Haidt and like Pluckrose and Lindsay and others who are old-fashioned liberals in the sense that they believe in truth. They believe that there are ways to adjudicate among truth claims. But most of the liberals, the old-fashioned liberals, are terribly afraid. It's the scientists, I have found, who are more likely to sort of push back on the postmodern rot and just through the production of the methodologies that they employ are the very antithesis of what's advanced by postmodernism.
I'm very grateful that very annoying speaker message has been ceased. So, JP, do you have a question for Professor Hill?
Not at the moment because I just came into the room. But I would love to. I would love to participate at some point.
Great, Alan.
Yeah. I was having a little problems there. I wanted to ask Professor Hill, since you've been a target of your students, speaking of, I believe it was you were mentioning Jonathan Haidt. He mentioned, his book, The Coddling of the American Mind, and the way students' attitudes have changed. I was reminded the other day, before I say that, he pinpoints the change to the mid-90s and being the first generation of students to grow up with social media. But I was reminded the other day, my mother was dean of business at a college back east. And I remember during the 90s, so this would be the generation before Jonathan Haidt's group of students, talking about the change in students' attitudes even then. So even before the protests the students took against you, had you noticed a change in students' attitudes and to education in general, or... was it, I don't think it could have been a complete surprise to you, but if you would like to comment on that, because certainly with Jonathan Haidt was talking about, I think came even earlier if my mother's representations were accurate.
Right. Thank you for that, Alan. I mean, I saw more than vestiges. I saw the sort of wholesale way in which we were completely ensconced in a paradigm of cultural and moral relativism as a student myself, which I, in my current book, What Do White Americans Owe Black People, I really talk about at length, because even as an undergraduate, I did my research and I traced it back, as have a lot of thinkers, to the 1960s, where you had the rise of victim studies or revolutionary studies, whether it be Black studies, queer studies, gender and women's studies, post-colonial studies. These studies had a couple of things in common. One was to criminalize reason and logic as being the constructs of racist white European thinkers. And one was to, the second was to function as units of advocacy and activism and not learning. And what they did, when you look at the methodologies of black studies, of women's studies, it was a complete attempt to undermine the traditional epistemological criteria that we had always had at our disposal for adjudicating among truth claims, for verifiability, for all the ways that we painfully arrive at discovering truth. Those studies, those victim studies, those revolutionary studies, were very, very pivotal in engaging in what's called standpoint epistemology, also in saying that, you know, unless you're a woman or unless you're Black or unless you're gay, there are two things. One is you can't have access to truth, because all truths, very much like the pragmatists, all truths are experientially located, you know, that is through my experience and my interest of my radical subjectivity. I have a truth that you can't access. And the old-fashioned ways of gauging truth were just racist and meant to keep minorities outside the domain of the ethical or the pantheon of the human community. So I traced it back to the 60s. I said, oh, Lord, just give me 20 years to sort of matriculate as a professor before, you know, the crap hits the roof. And so I like Haidt's book a lot, but I think it doesn't go far enough in explaining how the self-esteem movement and the touchy-feely, you know, rewarding effort and prioritizing that over results stemmed from something in critical theory, and then in the postmodern victims and revolutionary studies programs in the 1960s. Which sent an ominous message. It sent the message that the universities exist primarily as bastions of activism and advocacy and not as centers where something like objective knowledge can be disseminated and imparted to students. The whole idea of objectivity, the whole idea of disinterested scholarship and dispassionate scholarship, and the idea that history itself could be taught objectively, was completely discredited by these revolutionary studies programs. So that's where I would put, that's where, at least in my book and in my research, I have found the biggest locator of this kind of, or the explanatory model for the kind of relativism and sense of entitlement and everything that Haidt wonderfully describes in his books as being entailed by the calling of the American mind.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great. And anyone that wants to raise their hands can participate. We'll be glad to bring you up on the stage. Price, did you have a question?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Thanks for inviting me up. I appreciate it. Interesting points. Interesting conversation. Thanks for the thought-provoking ideas. On that idea of, like, you know, the attack on reason, objective truth, etc., what's your take on the vaccine controversies and the way that I would say an anti-scientific attitude seems to have taken hold amongst large segments or significant factions of the population, primarily on the right, but certainly not exclusively by any means? And I wonder how what you're describing feeds into a distrust of science, a turning of the scientific revolution into scientism, which I get that critique. But to me, I'm just wondering what your take is. My personal take is that a lot of the anti-vax disinformation and exploitation is, in fact, a betrayal of the scientific revolution, and exactly what you're talking about when you get the pushback from scientists, hard scientists, biologists, public health people, etc.
I couldn't agree with you more. This is the caveat. Let me just say, coming from a third world country where I received my first smallpox vaccination at 7, my vaccine for tuberculosis, my vaccine for malaria, I am so much of a vaxxer that I'm crazy. I mean, I'm vaccinated against shingles. I'm vaccinated against meningitis because I've had meningitis and it's not pretty. And I base my information on, when you're a child, you don't think about these things rationally. Your parents are thinking in terms of survival. We don't, you know, my mother had the vaccine against polio because she was born in 1946. I think that the radical skepticism and the radical way in which people live in their own curated silos, in which they self-select what counts as scientific and they self-select in terms of what they're going to subject to any kind of appraisal, is very, very limited. And I've just been very dismayed at the extent to which the whole vaccination of surrounding COVID has been politicized by both the left and the right. I personally think that, you know, the evidence is there to suggest that if you are vaccinated, you're much less likely to die or end up in the hospital. And I think this is empirically unfolding over and over again. The majority of people who die from COVID are not vaccinated. Now, that's their issue. And that's, you know, but I'm equally surprised at the reasons that are advanced for not wanting to be vaccinated. It has very little to do with actual scientific, citing the wonderful scientists, a lot of them coming out of Israel and the Netherlands, who speak within the realm of knowledge that they currently possess, on which we have to make our decisions. It's not even based on that. It's just based on something that is so visceral that is, it's a political response and not a scientific or a medical response that is fueling a lot of the anti-vaxxers. And I think that's quite, speaking apart from whether there should be mandates or that's a different issue, just the decisions, the criteria that people use when they make these decisions about whether or not to get a vaccination around COVID seems to have little to do with actual scientific evidence and is informed more by a kind of radical skepticism that almost seems pathological to me in certain cases, when the skepticism is taken to such a high degree of lunacy that conspiratorial theories start advancing themselves that themselves are not backed by anything evident. So, you know, I am vaccinated. I've got my booster, and I use the same kind of judgment that I would use if I were going to get when I got my shingle shot. And I think there are a couple other things I'm going to get vaccinated against, like pneumonia. So I love being stuck. I love needles. I love vaccinations. And as someone who travels a lot, who's been all over Asia, you know, Vietnam, Indonesia, China, all over South America, where I've lived for 4 or 5 months, where you have to get vaccinated against, inoculated against certain diseases. I tend to worry a little bit at the subjectivity and the political motives that people have, as opposed to being sort of parsing through various scientific viewpoints and then making a rational decision. I wouldn't be able to fault someone if they said, look, I've parsed through a lot of what the scientists in Israel are saying, a lot of what the scientists in the UK are saying, a lot of what the scientists are saying in America, and my informed decision is that I don't think I should get the vaccine. Very, very little of that you hear from people who are radical anti-vax.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you.
For that.
We're gonna go to JP, and then we'll get to Jorge and Liberty Shamrocker right after that.
Thank you. Jason, can I take the liberty to ask a more of a philosophical question?
Sure, of course, yes.
So, has how did the peer review start in science, and has it become corrupted and turned into a democracy far more than it should, and the scientific method relegated as just mere paperwork?
Well, you're asking me a question that's outside my sphere of knowledge. I'm not in the hard sciences, but I have sat on committees in which I've reviewed interdisciplinary works between philosophy and, let's say, philosophy of science and philosophy of physics. And my understanding is that the peer review process in science, I can't speak to its origins, historical origins, but as it operates today, is still much more objective and much more based on a consensus that itself is predicated on agreed upon norms and protocols for judging what counts as proper science than you will find in the humanities, where, as Peter Boghossian and Helen Pluckrose and James Lindsay did in their unmasking of the chicanery that's involved in peer review humanities, when they wrote a bunch of mumble jumble papers in postmodernism, informed by postmodern theory, and they got accepted. You'd be hard pressed to find something like that in the hard sciences. My experience has been, because one has to produce empirical data, one has to show that data is replicable in repeated settings, and the reality itself demands that science and the peer review method be a lot more objective, because there are certain results that are produced that must correspond with reality. In the humanities, unfortunately, you can spew any kind of conjectural nonsense, any kind of rubbish, back it up with, and get away with it. So I can't answer the first part of your question, because I'm not in the science field of science, and I have not taken it as my business to research how the history of the peer review in science operates. I will say, having had experience with chemists and physicists and having reviewed interdisciplinary papers in which physics and chemistry, to a lesser extent biology, I'm reviewing a paper actually right now by a biologist for an interdisciplinary journal. And just the precision, the lucidity of thought, the sort of calendrical exactitude with which people pay detail to empirical evidence and it's amazing. I'm still hopeful that it's the hard sciences that should be really, really protected. I think we've lost the humanities. They're gone. But the hard sciences are a lot more scrupulous in making sure that its peer review process remains very, very robust and is immune to the kind of, it's not entirely immune, but immune to the kind of politicization or politicized criteria that you find informing, let's say, a paper in 19th century, the 19th century novel, which I teach, the Victorian novel or something like that.
Thanks. If I could add one thing, Scott, this is David. Jason has drawn a contrast between the humanities and the physical sciences, essentially, the hard sciences. The social sciences are in between. Most of them are hopeless, but psychology is interesting because I have worked with other people in cognitive science, which involves psychology as well as philosophy and other fields. And there's still, among some people, a high degree of concern with truth. I most recently read a lot of stuff on cognitive bias literature for a project I was doing. And, you know, they're very careful. A lot of, I don't know about the peer review exactly, but I've read a lot of commentaries on other thinkers who are engaged in the field. And, the methodology seemed pretty sound, and the concern with getting the truth out seemed pretty sound. On the other hand, I have to say that Heterodox Academy was formed by Jonathan Haidt and several other people as a result of a paper that was written actually by a graduate student, Jose Duarte, and with Haidt about how the predominance of liberals and leftists in psychology blinded them often to assumptions they were building into their experimental protocols and calling for, you know, better, more diversity in that field. And that was, as I understand it, one of the origins of Heterodox Academy. So it's a mixed case, but there's some people in social science, if you call psychology a social science, who are, you know, more like the hard scientists you described than like the people in postmodern literature.
Thank you.
Great. I'm sorry, Jorge, do you have a
No, I was invited on stage. It's more, well, I guess I do. Professor Hill, nice to meet you. I was interested in hearing, you know, the comments that you made where it sounded like you were somewhat ostracized for, you know, taking the philosophical stances that you take. And this is, I guess it's more to maybe, it is a question, but it's also an inquiry to see if you're kind of aware of this. You know, Ayn Rand, you know, was a staunch capitalist, and I learned a great deal of my, you know, the premises that I have now about capitalism, I learned a great deal from her. And, you know, in following and learning, you know, her philosophy, you know, it was interesting how that all led to, you know, economics and sound money and those things. And I think that one of the things that, you know, the socialism or the socialists have done is they've gotten somehow the upper moral ground with the public at large in terms of like capitalism's about greed versus, we all know, it's rational self-interest. And, you know, the concept of money, people don't have this concept of money. So it was through this trail of philosophy that I discovered Bitcoin. And I was wondering how much Bitcoin is in your radar, or maybe the radar of other objectivists or Atlas Society. What I've discovered is that it very much is the almost like the ultimate expression of capitalism, in that it respects individual rights and, you know, property rights. And it's very, very much private. It's out of the hands of government. And, you know, we're basically everybody is a self-sovereign. And it all the checklists of everything, you know, that Ayn Rand would define as, you know, what the criterion for sound money. Now, United States, China, central banks have tried to destroy it, and they cannot. Because it's run by a code. It's outside of, you know, there's no human that owns it or runs it. It's very decentralized. And lately, it's as if the talking points are now with the socialists, you know, who very much want, you know, modern monetary theory and M2 on steroids, where they're destroying the US dollar through inflation. The way that it seems like they're wanting to attack Bitcoin is by, you know, associating it with extreme right wing conspiracy types and so forth. And so the talking points are out there, and I'm noticing it starting to hit the mainstream media. But I was wondering, I mean, certainly you have to be a capitalist to embrace Bitcoin. If you're a socialist who buys Bitcoin, you either don't know what you're doing or you're a hypocrite. How much is this on your radar? Have you guys explored this at all? Because I just think that this is, you know, we're missing a great opportunity here. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are, what you know about it.
I can also jump in, Jason, unless you want to take that.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
Yeah. Sorry about this. It is on our radar. We did an interview with Michael Saylor, of course, is one of the leading proponents of Bitcoin. We also have coming up on January 27th, you can check the events section of our website. Professor Richard Salzman, who's a Duke economist, is going to be holding a seminar on the economics and politics of cryptocurrency. I would say, from our perspective, I like to think of Bitcoin as the Riordan medal of currency. It's a human invention, achievement. It's something that's lighter, more portable, more secure than conventional fiat currency. And I do agree with you that it is something which is closer to what Ayn Rand saw as a proper currency, which should have been backed by gold or something that could not be inflated at whim.
Great. Go ahead.
No, I just want to say I'm a student of it, and I'm the biggest endorsement I could give is to say that I've just started buying, I won't say tons, but I'm investing in it. And I can't speak authoritatively, but I'm learning through a mentor, a Bitcoin, someone who earns money while he's taking a shower and went from being a tennis coach to now just being a full-time dad because that's how he makes his money. So I am learning as I go along by making my purchases and I completely agree with Jennifer that it's, you know, it's basically a non-perishable, durable commodity that's outside the sphere of government intrusion. And it's probably the closest thing that we might have to something like a gold standard today. Jennifer used the term metal standard. I would concur with that. But I'm learning a lot about it. I'm very optimistic about it, its status in our society. And I guess that's about as much as I can say. I'm not an expert on it. I'm learning and putting my actions where my mind is by actually making purchases and that sort of thing.
Professor Bill, I highly recommend that you read a book called The Bitcoin Standard.
Yes,
exactly. It'll take the that's history of money back from, you know, caveman days, let's say, through the evolution of society till now. I also want to say one more thing. There is a big, the crypto world, okay, it's split up between Bitcoin and everything else, right? And so it really is almost like Palestine versus Israel, Real Madrid versus Barcelona, or Yankees, Red Sox. I mean, to a Bitcoiner, anything that's not Bitcoin, they call a shitcoin, excuse my French. But just to illustrate the difference, and there are fundamental differences between the two, some of it being a proof of work versus a proof of stake system, decentralization versus centralization.
Some can inflate.
Right, correct.
Whereas Bitcoin, and, of course.
Right, yeah, let me finish this price. So,
and please, and we do want to get on to the other people.
Yeah, I just wanted to say this, and I think this is important, okay? So, because they can't kill it, the central banks have decided to take a portion of the Bitcoin technology, okay? And they're creating their own digital currencies, what's called a CBDC, a central bank digital currency. And this is going to sound really great. I'll just bring it up to you so everybody here can look into it. I'll land it. Give me 60 seconds. I'll land this. The CBDCs are going to sound great. They're going to try to position this for universal basic income. They're going to, if you have a flood, you'll have money at the speed of light. But what they won't tell you is that within 2 to 6 months, if you don't spend it, it'll go to zero. It'll kill savings, and it opens up the door for social engineering. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I just think it's an existential threat. I view it to individual rights and property.
Thank you, Jorge. Can we get to Liberty?
Go ahead, Liberty Shamrocker. Thank you for your patience.
Oh, not a problem at all. Not a problem. And I just want to make sure Jorge feels like he got his question answered.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring the awareness. Thank you. You have the floor.
Thank you so much. My question actually could be for Jason or for Jennifer, for that matter. And my question is, I need an elevator pitch, basically, to describe how altruism, basically, I have, between my husband and I, we have 5 daughters. And how could I, elevator pitch-wise, explain to them that taking care of themselves is not selfishness? It allows them to be able to give back more. So you could still be altruistic, but have the selfishness to know that you've got to replenish yourself, and you don't have to be a to be like a martyr. And I was just curious as to a quick pitch from both of you to explain that to our girls.
Well, I don't think that they're being altruistic. I think they're being properly selfish in the way that Rand would define selfishness. That is, in taking care of yourself, you esteem yourself as your highest value. First of all, you have to esteem yourself as your highest value in this life, and that whether it pertains to a proper diet, proper nutrition, exercise, choosing the right kinds of friends, rationally choosing the right kind of career, that one is being properly selfish in that respect, in the sense that one is pursuing actions, activities, values that are in one's self-interest, that leads to longevity of life, that leads to a life of flourishing, that leads to a life of rational happiness. So I don't know that they can have it. So that's not being altruistic. I mean, what would be altruistic is if they were to, in some sense, subordinate their own self-interest to the interest of other people. That is, to give away, to start making friends with, let's just use friendship, to start making friends with someone who's quite evil but is lonely. And if one of your daughters said something like, well, there's nothing in it for me, I just want to relieve you of your loneliness, knowing full well that this is a malignant narcissist who's going to attack her. And that's altruistic, because she's subordinating her rational self-interest and what's in her self-interest to the interest of another person, that is relieving their loneliness at her expense. So that's my take, is that it is properly selfish, not in the sense, the colloquial understanding of selfishness, which means somehow subordinating, violating other people's rights in order to advance one's own self-interest, but properly selfish in the sense of pursuing values, pursuing the means that are required, that are conducive, that are not inimical to one's self-interest, but that are required for one's continued life as a rational being. And just going beyond mere survival, that will lead to a life of flourishing and thriving. And if one wants to make the decision to help other people, that's proper. But notice that you cannot help other people, I would argue, unless you first attend to the values that make you be the best being, rational being, that you can possibly be. If you were to pursue values or pursue activities or actions that undermined your well-being, then you couldn't really, really give back to society or be of service to anyone, because you would have been compromised. You would have had a compromised agency, a compromised psyche that would stymie your efforts to sort of help other people.
Thank you.
Can I just add, Scott and Jennifer, there's an argument to be made, I've made it, that benevolence, including helping other people under certain circumstances, is a legitimate part of an egoistic ethic. It's in your self-interest to forge good relationships with people, and that's what I mean by benevolence. And that is something that can involve, in certain circumstances, being charitable helping others with no immediate knowledge of what you're going to gain from it. But still, it is profitable and rational in the long term.
Great. Roger, enjoyed your forum on capitalism the other
day. Yeah, no, I first of all, I should thank Jennifer and David for showing up for that. That was amazing. Brought a tremendous amount of value to that room, and the feedback that I got was overwhelming. And so if we do something similar, I'd love to get you back to do something like that again. I do have a question for Jason, though, Professor Hill. On this app, and you've participated in some of these conversations around CRT, I wanted to get your thoughts on, outside of CRT, these derivatives that are being taught and being relabeled as other things, but under the scope of bringing Frankfurt School thinking and this critical theory into the classroom. Like, what advice would you have for parents, you know, that are in a school district where some of these things are being taught? You know, aside from going to the school board and talking to the teachers, would you recommend the nuclear option of, pulling children out and looking at school choice? Like, what practical tools do parents have if they're concerned about these things?
That's a great question. And I'm really glad that you asked it, because I am actually meeting with the mayor of Irvine, Texas, through Zoom, by the invitation of a parent who is objecting to certain pornographic novels being taught to 6th and 7th graders, with everything from the best way to perform oral sex to having anal sex. It's explicit in the novel called Jack of Hearts. And she reached out to me, and she's raising ruckus in Irvine by getting other parents involved. I'm meeting with the mayor as an academic, as an expert on CRT. I've written about it extensively, to talk to the mayor. So I think a kind of radical activism on the part of parents who can understand what in the name of CRT, which is an umbrella term which is used to justify a bunch of egregious actions that to me seem like child abuse against children who do not have the skills to contest them. A kind of radical activism on the part of parents to sort of get really involved in their children's education. I'm surprised at the extent to which parents will call me or have called me if their child has gotten a B or a C on a test in a nice way. Like, I just want to know why they got a C, but have no interest in the content of the material. And the primary, I know some objectivists don't like this term, socialization. I will use it anyway, but the primary way in which we induct students into civility and civic behavior and being part of a individual, but nevertheless part of a community, is primarily through the parents, not the school, I would say. And so what I know is that superintendents and union leaders and principals do not like confrontation. They sort of rely on the silence, the recalcitrance of these parents. And the minute parents start raking a ruckus by demanding something like a meeting with the mayor of a town, meeting with calling for the resignation of superintendents, but having the facts to back up what you're saying, right? Not just being some sort of loudmouth, but showing actual excerpts from various books and articles that are being shoved down the throats of these students. And then, you know, I think that's the best way first. I'm not an advocate of public education, I must say. You know, I think people's procreative choices, they're fiscally responsible for their procreative choices. But we do have a system of education, public education, and once it exists, because the reason I'm a little reluctant is because the charter schools are as woke as they come. There is growing evidence to show that, especially on the East Coast, in New York, in Boston, that these charter schools are mimicking and aping the curricula that we find in the public schools. So I'm not even optimistic about the charter schools. I think a more nuclear revolutionary role has to be played by parents who really, really take to task those policymakers that make the decision as to what students are being taught in the classroom and become vigilantes and warriors on behalf of the rational minds of their children.
Good stuff. I think we can squeeze in Jimmy, co-host of Liberty Shamrock.
Yeah, thanks for having me up here. Yeah, I too was part of that room that Roger had, and that's what kind of struck my interest in the Atlas Society. I liked a lot of things I heard there. I wish more people would have stuck around for the duration, but it was a very long room. But anyways, my question here is I want to take what Jorge was saying, and oh, it looks like he's not even here anymore, about Bitcoin, but take it a step farther. This is just my kind of theory, but I don't believe we live in a capitalist society. I believe it's more of a corporatist or a corruption of some corrupt form of capitalism. But it's definitely not true for free market capitalism. So what would you be in favor of, in 1913, they created the Federal Reserve, which centralized our monetary system. Would you be in favor of just abolishing the Fed and just getting rid of that?
Yeah, I've gone on record as saying abolishing the IRA, not the IRA, the IRS, abolishing the income tax. I think I stand here with Rand. I'm for the complete separation of state and economics, that the government functions as an arbiter and the holder of contracts, and that the federal government, the Fed's encroachment on private property, and the sort of the very circuitous ways and seemingly inconspicuous ways in which private property is really, to talk about inheritance tax is one of my favorite things, functions as what Rand would call, you know, a legalized gunman, at least legalized theft, really. So yes, the answer to your question is absolutely yes. If the government provided the services that it's really supposed to provide and don't go beyond that, then I see no reason for a bloated totalitarian regime that we're fast approaching. I would say one thing. I still think that this is a capitalist society in the sense that, you know, there are constitutive definitions of capitalism, and we approximate pure capitalism, but we haven't gotten there. I don't think we've ever had anything like really, really pure capitalism. But I think there's still necessary conditions that give the definition its conceptual heft that are in place that still allows us to say, predominantly speaking, America is still basically a capitalist society. People might disagree with me on that one.
Thank you, Jason. That takes us right up to the top of the hour. So I want to thank everybody for coming, for your great questions. Thank my buddy Scott for helping me out here. As I'm undergoing these various emergencies here in Austin. I want to invite all of you to come and join us back on Tuesday. We're going to have a clubhouse with Rob Trusinski. He's actually going to be talking about education and looking for some of these solutions to the intensifying acrimony and struggle that we're having over these curricula and the kind of content that's been taught. And he's looking to some European models of school choice. And then on Tuesday, we're going to have another clubhouse with another one of our senior scholars, Richard Salzman. Again, he's the economist on our staff. So perhaps we can talk a little bit more about Bitcoin then, although the topic of that particular clubhouse is going to be our price controls coming. So thanks everyone, and hope to see you then.